Welcome to Leaders Talk. Our guest today is the South African brain researcher and CEO of NeuroZone, Dr. Etienne van der Walt.
The one thing that I can say that really helped me was to really celebrate all the small victories. So we took a very, very purposeful, committed approach to say every single small victory that we achieved in this company, we will celebrate as if we made it big time.
Leaders Talk, the interview podcast portraying leaders who are committed to better leadership, better organizations, and a better world. Hosted by managing partner of Leadership Choices and co-founder of the Cosmic Foundation, Carsten Drath.
Etienne is a neurologist. He spent 15 years studying and practicing neurology, neuroscience in different countries, in the Netherlands, in the UK, in South Africa, obviously. But then something interesting happened. He felt the need to leave the medical field and start his own company, NeuroZone, which happened back in 2010. And the intention of NeuroZone is to use the knowledge and the research that is done in the medical field, but not to applying this to pathology. So in other terms, how do people get sick and how can we cure them? But rather to the field of high performance, meaning how can leaders, teams, and businesses use the insights of neuroscience, the data, the analytics, and apply them to thrive, to build collective intelligence, and to build a higher level of resilience altogether. And how that all comes together, what drives him there, what is his passion, all of that, I'm discussing with Etienne. So let's dive right into the conversation with Dr. Etienne van der Walt. A very warm welcome to Dr. Etienne van der Walt. Welcome, Etienne, to the show.
Carsten, thank you very much. It's great to be with you, man. Yeah, long-standing friend, and yeah, I'm looking forward to this.
Me too, Etienne. So what do you do? You are in sunny South Africa right now. The sun might be coming out, and I'm only a little bit jealous, I have to say. So Etienne, what do you do, and who are you actually?
Yeah. Thanks. So Carsten, as you say, I'm a South African, proudly South African. I live in Cape Town. I am a clinical neurologist, but not practicing at the moment. Currently, I work as the CEO and co-founder of NeuroZone, a neuroscience analytics company, and who also uses systems thinking to enhance resilience, to keep people well, but also, as I said, upstream, really ensure high performance resilience. And this is what I'm keeping myself busy with now full time. It is a full time job. There is so much needed in the space of resilience and well-being today, of course, with the mental pandemic. And so that's hitting everybody. Burnout is rife. The world is changing so rapidly. So in that sense, I'm very grateful to be part of a journey that helps us to stay on this curve of rapid change.
So in a nutshell, what I understood from you, NeuroZone is on the one hand side an analytics company, meaning you have assessments to measure the resilience and other capabilities of people, and then also give them suggestions how to improve. That's one thing, right? And the other thing I heard is that you also have like journeys, resilience development journeys that you have developed. Can you speak to that real quick?
Yeah, so very briefly, the closer we come to the granular science, the more I feel at home, of course. So we are all about the credibility of the science. From far, we are a product house or a platform through which we provide analytics and content, neuroscience and systems-based content, plus the analytics for the use of a variety of different industries who would want to implement this. For example, we've got coaching and assessments where we have almost 500 coaches that we have trained up to be able to use our assessments with individuals, teams, organizations, depending on how they work. And they can use this, as I said, individuals, teams, organization fashioned. But we also have created the High Performance Resilience Journeys, which we use directly with clients, with companies. And there we do also bring in coaching and consultants. So we have consultants as well at NeuroZone. Of course, the dream is that as a product house that we can expand this and provide this eventually as a product for many consultants who are not necessarily part of NeuroZone. We also have platform partners. As a proper platform, if you may, we have platform partners who provide even their own user interfaces, whether those are online assessments or online or an app for their own industry. And there are a variety of industries we are working with at the moment, unemployment to employment. We're working with students and schools with a variety of different pilots at the moment. Furthermore, even with communities, church leaders, very interesting, congregations, and then master plan communities. So there's a whole community aspect to this, which is something which excites me greatly. So there are a variety of ways that the NeuroZone system can be used as a platform for resilience. I hope that helps a bit.
Absolutely. And then you're also the mastermind, the chief evangelist, the keynote speaker who speaks on conferences. And funny thing, we ended up sharing a session on a global conference a couple of weeks back, and they had asked us individually, not knowing that we are old friends and we kind of delivered together. What a fun coincidence. And you just bring it back to the brain. And Etienne, if I compare your company to other companies, is it fair to say that you are still very deep into research and science and neurology that is really an active component?
Yeah, absolutely. Carsten, this is why it was so great to actually work with you. Yeah, totally. This is a bit I got a few bit of goosebumps when you spoke to that, because I thought it was such a great fit. And the way that this fits so well is specifically because we come from the very scientific granular perspective and say, what are the granular components that build resilience really by actually providing well-being to the brain-body system, setting it up for its best performance, and then how can you take that and then translate that in an integrated fashion into the world of work, into the world of study, and the world of play, and so forth. So that is exactly the case. We are deep vertical, as we often call ourselves, and we try to really stick to that. That's why when we are in this space, for looking at original behavioral components, data, and the way that the data in helps us to optimize what we offer in a way that we probably never knew before. That's where I become really excited. And that's where NeuroZone, I think, comes to his right.
And we first met in 2015 on a conference. And what I've observed since then is that at that point, the thinking was very much around how does the brain function as a problem-solving entity and how is it integrated to the rest of the body. And if I listen to you now, 8 years later, I think the systems thinking, the interconnectedness of humans, the how humans work together as a team, that has come into your thinking as well.
Yeah, totally. And as you know, once again, I think in humility, we have to just say we are just following a trend. We are part of the global consciousness of humanity. And the global consciousness of humanity has been placing so much emphasis on the collective, collaboration, interconnectedness, the way that we stick together, the importance of teams, the importance of the collective to give us collective resilience, which gives us an outcome that is so much bigger than the sum of the parts, which should actually keep us on the curve of rapid accelerated change, right? Otherwise, we burn out. And so that kind of consciousness, we are very fortunate to be part of, and therefore we actually speak to that particular aspect of the system, the whole system of life. It's a bit like you and I are not the end product of organs at work and collective organs. We also are organs of a collective system called the team or the family. We families and teams are collective organs of organizations and so forth, right into society. And of course, we're part of an interconnected system of life. So understanding that also gives us the additional value of studying the effects of team resilience on an individual. Individual resilience on my organs, even if you may want to go that granular, but you can see that there's a whole interplay there And that piece, as you rightfully put it, Carsten, we added over the past 5 years. It has never been as prominent as now, of course.
So it's probably a big question to ask, but what is known so far around the science of how human brains, brain-body systems work together to solve problems, or how resilience is collectively created or disassembled if a team is not working well? Two questions in one, sorry, but where do we stand in terms of knowledge generation?
Yeah, it's such a mystery, isn't it? I mean, let's for a moment say the mystery of the whole that is so different and greater than the sum of the parts is at the core of life, if you may. You put the components of a cell together, you get a cell. But if you think of it from a living perspective, you get life. And life is so different, so much different. And the yield for that is so much bigger. And on that note, I just want to make one little comment because it's so fascinating. We speak so much about AI now, and we think about computers. Computers are even AI computers make use of very small but humongously massive amounts of linear processing that makes it look multi-nodal, if you may. But basically, because it is still linear, it uses a huge amount of energy. I mean, the energy that is used by supercomputers is almost ridiculous. Now, if you think about that, what makes us so different as biological entities is that the brain is able to do so much more from that multi-nodal kind of perspective, but at such low energy. And that's what makes us so phenomenal. The energy efficiency of the brain gives us a capability where we say low energy, high yield. Now, it's just building on that. Low energy, high yield is what you're looking for when you have a very efficient collective, right? When you are really flowing in flow together, there's synchronization, which you speak to Carsten just now. That synchronization also needs to, as a living entity, demonstrate a low energy and a much higher yield for that new group, and so on and so forth. It's a whole process of flow, which we just call in the neurozone. So the neurozone name actually says that's into the neurozone. You want to move into that space. And what are the drivers that can get us there? So what we do know is that it's real. When you and I go into sync and we're in synergy, our EEG, our brain's patterns, waves start to synchronize. We can see it on EEGs. If you put little EEGs around people's heads, and one can go and Google that and see examples of these studies that's being performed on teams. We know that the things that drive that process are a number of insights and a number of things that need to be in place from a collective perspective. You effectively have to remove all the stuff that hinders this. It's a bit like singing, right? We sing effortlessly. We remove everything that actually interferes, and the stress of life interferes. So you want to remove things like a lack of safety. So you want to be very sure that there's a deep sense of social safety, bonding and belonging. In small groups where there's the synchronization in teams, we need deep entrustment. We need belonging. These are driven by things like oxytocin and dopamine, the neurotransmitters that that actually work on these different components, bonding and belonging, for example. We need to have an energy system that's looked after well, meaning that you reduce the negative thought patterns, you reduce the components that work on this system as bad habits and so forth. When they are reduced in this collective, you now replace them with, for example, the energy maximizers, like optimism and gratitude and curiosity and enthusiasm and humor. And it sounds almost like, yeah, but we all know all these things. The point is, it is so real that they actually have a direct effect on this system that enables us to start to synchronize together to get to that state of flow. The next one is the whole idea of psychological safety, right? Equal turn taking, the fact that I'm safe and I can make my points and Carsten can make his points. And we both actually allow ourselves to think in each other's shoes, not only feel in each other's shoes, so that cognitive empathy. We know these things. But we've now seen that if you get a certain number of those well into play, that you have a much higher chance of going into that state of flow, which then creates, in the systems way, the next living system and the living entity, which of course, great leadership needs to understand well and get right.
If we apply this to team resilience, collective resilience? This, I mean, what? How would you say from a neurobiological concept perspective, how is team resilience created? When is it strongest?
So team resilience is strongest when you have these factors that I just mentioned, have optimized them properly. Individuals need to be well. It's a bit like you and me, our organs and our body. I cannot be well if my liver is not well, right? If I have a bad liver, it's going to cause problems in the whole system. I'll give you an example. The liver, as we know, all organs have got sleep-wake cycles. Even your liver goes to sleep. It's not only the brain. So the point is, if the liver is unwell, the brain is not going to be well either. We know that, for example, severe liver failure causes death. It causes brain toxicity and brain death. Everything is connected. In the same way, we as a team, as individuals within a collective, are all deeply connected. And we are connected in a way that we actually have, we have immune systems and blood vessels, and they're all kinds of things that connect. To understand that, of course, it sounds almost like mystic and a bit crazy. The point is that it does exist. It does mean that we do have something that interconnects us in the same way that our organs are connected in a very physical way. We, in an emotional way, connect so that there are transfer of information. And the transfer of the information is so critical. Transfer of information requires these things that in an individual require that individual organ as well. So the individual organ needs to be well through being safe, being maximized in terms of the energy that's available, being well looked after through rhythms of exercise, mindfulness, and so on. So you can see that, once again, this speaks to self-leadership and leadership, and it says some things that, Carson, that's been known for so long already, right, in the world of business and leadership. Self-leadership and leadership is basically the same thing, just of a different entity, a living entity, individual and team. And so the idea of self-leadership and leadership is critical. You cannot have a team without good self-leadership in the individuals. You cannot have flow in the team. Now, those are the components that drive it. And then from a team perspective, of course, you are not going to flow if the cognitive load is too much. So, of course, we always understand that, right, that the skill sets and the knowledge and so forth are critical for what you need to achieve. So don't override the challenge. The challenge shouldn't override our capacities. Then it doesn't really matter. You're just not going to achieve it. But the point is, if you had all of those in place, your chances of moving into that state of flow, that is at its best then. And we've been able to see that it happens. So good teams, of course, are going to flow. Sports teams, good examples. I'll use one example. I'm sure you'll use another one, because they both exhibited the same thing. We just think a bit about football or soccer. The Spanish football team who won the World Cup in 2010 in Cape Town, well, actually in Johannesburg in the final, I was fortunate enough to see them in real, you know, at the stadium in 2010. They went into a synchronous dance. It's goosebump stuff. You can see, and I'm actually a bit of a novice when it comes to football, but I could see that there's something happening here. You can see how they all go into a synchronous dance, and you see that they're just unstoppable now, and they score a goal. And I'm pretty sure you can say the same, for example, of Germany. I think it was the year after when Germany beat, was it Brazil or Argentina? I think they beat Brazil in Brazil and then went on and beat Argentina in the final. Am I right? I think that was right. But the point is,
weak spot for me.
If I'm wrong, please forgive me. But once again, Germany had the same thing, and you can see this in good teams. They go into this state of flow. It's a new organism that came alive, and that's what you want to achieve.
And another thing that I find fascinating, Etienne, is since you have so much data that you are collecting, and you were also collecting during COVID, what you found out is that obviously, there are certain habits that keep us well and that foster our resilience, that make us stronger. But what you found out is that it's not at all times the same habits that are most effective. It also changes with the context that we live in, especially when we go into a lockdown. So what did you guys learn there?
Yeah, this is mind-boggling stuff. And it makes so much sense if you unpack this, right? So I usually use a little elevator pitch and say, if somebody tells you what are the top 10 things you have to do to be resilient, you can probably know that that is inaccurate for you because it was measured in someone else in a different time context, a time and physical context. It's so dynamic. So what we learned is we studied over 65 different behaviors, and these would range from optimism, gratitude, a sense of making a meaningful contribution, sense of belonging, a trust. And I'm just mentioning a number of things, rhythms, exercise, different types of mindfulness, sleep, wake. Just so I think people understand, it really ranges right from sleep, wake, exercise, mindfulness, right up to the energy system, safety, and even how we cognitively solve problems. And we studied these 65 behaviors in our system. Before COVID, because we collected data across the globe in different places, the different individual variances within these different areas, we couldn't actually see it. It was just too much noise because it was small. And so it equaled out the process a bit. And so we could see a fairly stable code, which means that not the number one predictor of resilience was optimism before COVID. The number two predictor was reducing negative thoughts. And the number three was practicing the generic parts technique, which is a way of solving problems, right? Just breaking a problem up into its smallest parts and then allow your brain to piecemeal a solution together. And then the fourth one was having a sense of making a meaningful contribution in the workplace. And then 61 others followed. When COVID came, we all had one big variable that affected us, and that was lockdown, right? As you say, Carson. So we locked down. And lockdown affected the whole world in the same way. And we continued to collect data. So over the period of lockdown and over 18 months, we saw how the code statistically significantly shifted. And eventually, after about 9 months, became stable. It stabilized then. So it was an interesting shift. And then it stabilized. And the number one predictor of resilience then was exercise diversity. The number two was exercise duration, and the number three was avoiding destructive habits, and the number four was having a sense of making a meaningful contribution in the workplace, mm-hmm. which still maintained the number four. Effectively, you could think, but hey, we actually all thought, hey, I'm locked down, so I need to exercise. And so what is fascinating about the study and the fact that it was predictive as opposed to just correlative, it was there was causality, effectively said, What we most likely did is unconsciously, the world as a global unconscious organism, it's a bit mystic again, had the sense of what is most important for us now. And therefore, we were talking exercise. We could see that that was the best predictor of the resilient system, which keeps us in a baseline relaxed physiological state and keeps us ready to perform at our best, prevents burnout and keeps us well. So it's a dynamic system. And then afterwards, now we start to study smaller and smaller groups. And we are now well aware of the fact that there's a dynamic nature to resilience and to our behaviors. It makes a lot of sense because we're complex and adaptive. And we've got many more than just one or two things that I need to do to be resilient. And all the things that in my body is continuously happening is affected by an external environment, an internal milieu. And within that, there is some things that can actually shift as things in the external changes. We have to readjust. And that readjustment is continuous and dynamic. It's called we call this the neurozone equilibrium, which all speaks to the equifinal point of being in a baseline relaxed physiological state. So you and I continuously have to be in that state where we have longevity, where we have well-being, but also where we are right ready to perform at our best. And this is the way the system then does it. It continuously responds to the external changes in the environment.
And
it's important.
The way you use your hands is like a scale. It's like a balancing act, right? So what is needed now? Yeah. How do we need to, as a team, adapt to the circumstances in order to bring out these factors that we need most now to stay at our best and our optimal performance?
Well, exactly. And you know, Carson, the important thing for modern organizations, I say modern because not everywhere in the world we have the same kind of progress. But if you have a certain progressive organization, for example, I'm just thinking, I mean, where you guys are in Europe, you've got throughout, companies should really take this, and I'm sure are actually doing this, are really taking stock of, hey, what's going on in the data ecosystem. I heard a beautiful word, a data lake. There's a lake of data around everybody, right? So what is happening in the data lake around every employee, around every leader in an organization? And how can we measure that? And that's a dynamic place, right? The data lake shifts continuously, but it gives us so much information about you and me. How do we do emails? How do we do this and that? Of course, you know, the whole idea of privacy of privacy of data is so important. If we can get that right and we can measure around the data lake, continuously bring in the data, understand what's going on in the data lake of the organization as an organism, bring in that data, you can now have the balancing act between external information and internal, continuous internal optimization. And you can start to predict. And now you can, a bit like the weather, predict the weather and you can get your jersey before the cold hits you. And that's the kind of plan with all the technology that's available. Now I'm going fast forward a bit into the future, but we know the future is now. We have to prepare for that, work with that, so we can be ready for optimization.
We can see the passion for research sparkling in your eyes. And here's a question for you. What I observe is that when we are in the world of neuroscience, we are in the world of natural science. When we are in the world of management or teams working together, we are in systems thinking. So we are actually, you are bridging natural science and social sciences with that. And there's a lot of complexity going on. And it's, I can see how you're fascinated by complexity. But when you talk to leaders, we oftentimes deal with people that have an attention span of several minutes, let's say, if we are gracious. And then how do you get all this complexity across? What is your experience? How do you simplify it so that leaders can work with that?
Yeah, absolutely. Because the world, exactly as you say, the world of leaders and in which leaders have to operate is extremely complex in its own right. They've got a few minutes to pay attention to this crazy geeks coming from laboratories and, you know, what can you tell me? So you have to be very clear. And so I try to stick to themes and say there are themes that we have to look after. If you think about your organization as a living entity, you have to pay attention to a number of themes and understand them as insights. And those insights have to drive you into the space of high performance. Usually I start with, what does the sea look like that we swim in? And so we all understand that intuitively, the mental pandemic, the world of rapid accelerated change, and so on. Then the next one is, we speak to this idea that you need two major components in an organization to perform well. One is all the lifeless components. It's the management. It's managing using systems, and now I'm using systems in a lifeless way, right? I'm talking about the systems we have, the automated systems we use, automation, and so on and so forth. And we need systems, and they are critical, but they are lifeless, and they are managed by managers. But the same managers also need to lead the living entity, which are the people. And how do you actually get that leadership of people right? You know, I started to talk about the organization as the organ in capitals, the organization, and how do you look after the organization with the capitals? And so when leaders really, so leaders get this, and we talk leadership, now we talk living entity. And then I say, okay, now we have to think systems. And then you go through the themes of a living system, of energy is finite, and how do you get a high yield for energy assigned to tasks? How does that drive you into the zone for high performance? How does that actually, what does it look like? And what are these important nuggets that you have to look after, or the themes of social safety, the psychological safety, the collective creativity? How do you ensure that you have a mindset, a global mindset? And global mindset also speaks to the fact that it's that we live in a system. A global mindset also, for example, don't only see purpose as a goal that we set and with a why because it's important. That's the one piece that's critical. But it also speaks to the deep belief that you and I are part of a higher order living entity. So life doesn't stop with Etienne and with Carsten. If you think about leadership choices is a higher entity than Carsten, of which Carsten is an organ of, and Etienne is of Neurozone. And that higher purpose, that is called purpose in life. And then when these things, you know, are actually, it's simple things, but it's important nuggets that drive the way that the mindset shift for leaders, so that they can position their strategies around this going forward, because they have to look after the system the systemic issues of a company, the culture of a company, and so forth. We also speak to, of course, to mindset and mindfulness and so forth, but that's more on a personal level. Mm-hmm. But my understanding is that leaders really grasp this very quickly. Leaders are very clever, very intelligent, highly intelligent people, very aware of what's going on around them in the world. And when you bring this to the forefront, the insight drops very quickly and, you know, leads to that kind of mindset shift.
Okay, and it's me again with a special announcement. End of July, I'll be starting my next part of my tour around the world by bicycle. And the aim of the tour is to raise money for the Cosmic Foundation. And the aim of the Cosmic Foundation is to give purpose-driven NGOs free of charge access to coaching, leadership development, and resilience development. If you think this is a great thing, then please visit our website, which is aroundtheworldbybike.blog. But you can find it on the Leadership Choices website, for example, and you can find it in the notes for this podcast. And now, back to the fascinating conversation with Etienne. Let's go. Great. Etienne, I would like to unravel a little bit what brought you to become the Etienne that you are today. So let's go back, if you allow me to, back to, you know, the family that you come from. What's the situation like? I learned that one of your grandfathers was the founder of Sasol, which is one of the biggest, oil company, is that, or gas, yes, company, right? Natural resources company in South Africa. And there's also some German ancestors, and there's a mix of missionaries, industrials, and entrepreneurs in your family tree. So what kind of a family was that you were born into?
Well, that's fascinating. I suppose, interesting thing, Carsten, I always feel a bit shy to speak about myself, but you've asked me now. You got me here on the spot, so I'm gonna go for it. I'm very privileged to have come from a number of different European ancestors. So I still have cousins actually in Germany, in Heidelberg, so to speak. I think I told you that when you and I saw each other there. So I've got second removed cousins living in Heidelberg still. But also got strong French ancestry and Dutch ancestors, and so it's a nice European mix. The family that I come from, I would say, were entrepreneurial, industrialists, and mathematicians, and teachers. And so the thing that really gets me going is to be able to teach and speak. I suppose that's quite obvious. I think you and I share that too. I love teaching. I love speaking to people, sharing thoughts and ideas. So I've got a lot of that makes me really tick. The other one that is valuable for me is a deep entrepreneurial spirit, a dream. My grandfather, who started Sasol, started dreaming of making oil from coal when he was 15 years old, and he was very privileged to continue that throughout and be able to eventually found the Sasol as we know today. My father was an entrepreneur. He was a chemical engineer, and he, for him, everything was about how can I actually use my chemical engineering, but to combine it with his passion, which was food. And so they created a number of well-known labels in their factory at the time. But now, after his death, it still continues as a well-known brand in South Africa. And he was a serious entrepreneur. You know, he told me once that he had at one time 200 different products that they were experimenting with in the laboratories at NOLA in Randfontein up in Johannesburg in South Africa, but they only had a few which were at a product market fit stage and already being commercialized. So he had, I would assume, the privilege of having a laboratory where he could keep them and he could sort of ring fence them. Now, if you go into the world of complex adaptation and the way that we build the platform, it's a bit harder to ring fence stuff, right? To actually keep them in the laboratory and really just work with a product that have actually got a market fit and is scalable. But I think there was a lot of that that I've learned and lived with as a kid. I had no doctors in our family. Maybe the missionary side also got hold of me, and I see myself as an altruist who really care about the human condition. Mm-hmm. And that drove me a lot. And that's why I became a doctor. Before I became a doctor, I was a little bit lost in a variety of things. It wasn't that simple. I studied a BSc with chemistry and mathematical statistics and completed the degree. So maybe that's where the analytics side came in as well, that I completed this subject that's also used in actuarial science. And I did chemistry because I thought that I should also work at Sasol. But after a while, I realized that, hey, I really want to work with people, and went into the medical field, started all over again. And then one thing led to the other, and I was very fortunate to complete neurology, to become a neurologist, because I was very fascinated by how the brain works and effectively how people work. And I remember when completing neurology, it was clear to me already that I would not be work with one-on-one patients for very long. And I was more interested in the sort of global idea of medicine. And that led to a number of things. Eventually, as a neurologist, I worked in the UK for a number of years, also in the Netherlands, and then in South Africa, also taught in South Africa at the Academic Hospital in Cape Town. But at that time already, I was very fascinated by the need of brain, of performance capacity. And that was actually arguably in the most important part of life, if you may, of the stage of life, and that was early childhood. So I started focusing on that.
Before we go there, there's this. So you invested 15 years in this world of neurology, and I mean, normally there's a lot of hard work and the studies, and they really, it's like, you know, they make you sweat, they make you learn and study hard, and there's super hard exams, and then eventually you make it. You take a breather, and then you have more tests and more stuff that you need to achieve. But eventually, you capitalize on your career, and you become a famous neurologist with a great practice. And then you have patients, and you know the system kind of churns out money. You're successful. You're, you know, all of that stuff. But once you reach that level, you didn't want that. What drove you to leave that safe space that you had created for yourself and go into yet another restart in your life?
Yeah, that's such a good question. I was fortunate to follow an organic need as opposed to a cognitive belief of what will be good from a more, I would think, public opinion, if you may. That also was a private opinion, by the way. So I had a family. We support each other very strongly, but at the same time, you know, Carson, I was definitely not completely. It wasn't that acceptable, you know, for me to just jump out of a very successful practice at the top of my career and to almost start all over again. Looking back, I absolutely respect everybody who said you must be crazy. Because I was, I assume, it was a crazy idea. However, I was driven by a deep passion to actually look after people who are well or who are not ill enough yet, where you can do almost nothing anymore. To use the understanding of the brain-body system and how we function. Above the line, if you may, and not under the line only. So I wanted to move above the line of functionality and say, what can we do here to keep people well? And the next step was I had to learn about high performance because it's all along the same spectrum, right? So for me, I was never interested to really look after people to decode the superhuman, if you may. For me, it was more about ensuring that people are well, have longevity, and prevent them from falling ill and going into the hospitals of the world. Of course, we cannot prevent that, but maybe we could postpone it so that you and I rather reach that stage in our lives when we are genetically programmed to get there. So for me, that was so important. And I was driven by this passion of just using this knowledge in a novel way to contribute to that process. And of course, I stumbled into the world of business because, hey, such a large part of the world works and really needs support. And of course, today it's more important than ever. I assume otherwise we wouldn't have sat here. It's just more important than ever. So it was a good time to start then because it really comes to fruition now.
Okay. And so what I hear is that this focus on how do people get sick and how to cure them. At one point, you realize that can't be the answer to it. We need to find out how people stay healthy. And also, how do we get into the realm of high performance, which is yet another dimension or yet another level that I find fascinating, the spectrum that you are kind of pointing out and how to do that. And therefore, you kind of to leave the space of medicine and enter the world of business highly linked to medicine or natural science. But before that, you tried that within the system, if I recall correctly. So at one point, you started to focus on early childhood brain development when you were still a neurologist and you had kind of teachers working in an open space next to your laboratory with all the EEG and fMRTs and all that stuff. How did that come about?
Yeah. Maybe one step back. While I was specializing in neurology at the medical school, I became good friends with the dean and the deputy deans and so forth at the faculty. And we were part of a committee group who looked after a number of the policies at the faculty. So I was one of the younger guns who were part of that process. And when I completed my specialization, I was going to Wellington in New Zealand to work there. I was offered a job, got the job. And after the successful telephone interview, I went to the dean and said, "Hey, man, I'm leaving." And the dean said, "But hey, man, don't you want to stay for maybe just another year or two and develop a rural school, a rural health school for us?" And I thought, well, that's interesting. But something else resonated with me because this actually resonated with me because it was about health, more public health, as opposed to individual health. And I think for me, that's always been a refrain in my life. I care about the group to look after the public health and public well-being and well-being. It's that resonated more with me than looking one-on-one after one person and giving them their medication or their surgery. So Carson, I think that was what made me move into that space. And it was while I was walking on these platforms, I call them platforms, in the rural health areas of South Africa in the Western Cape, and the poverty that I saw there and that I really tasted, I came to the realization that if I had $10, I would put $9 into early childhood brain development, because the big loss, preventable loss of brain capacity happens in the very, very early, let's say, first 1,000 days of a child's life. And this is where my real, I think, passion started to say, listen, I actually want to do something here. So I started reading on early childhood brain development over time and became a sort of a layman, sort of, I would call myself probably, in Afrikaans, we call this a kortbroek expert. It's a short pants expert, which just says you don't have a long pants, but so you know something, but not everything. So I actually read into early childhood brain development. And then, of course, the next thing led to another need to another. And eventually I was fortunate to start Amazing Brains. And today it's a fully fledged program to build early childhood brains, if you may, to support that build, the development, because we don't build brains. Kids develop themselves. We have to remove all the obstacles, the toxic stress and so forth. so that the children can develop to their full capacity and potential.
And then, I mean, that would have been another avenue to pursue for you. But then there was this, I really want to take this to the level of the business. I really want to start my company. And then kind of leaving the system. And I mean, we have been to the same things here. Starting a company is not a pleasure cruise. It's has a lot of ups, a lot of downs. It's a lot of fighting, wrestling with all kinds of stuff that are not sexy, like accounting and IT and all of that. So what gave you that hunger to pursue this?
For me, the most important thing is that it was an inner drive. Without the inner drive, I would have not done this. And the inner drive for me was not to make money, but to achieve the dream. That was my dream, was to support well-being, longevity, and high performance for people of all different walks of life. I'm saying this specifically, Carsten, because it sounds like a cliche, right? I have friends who were entrepreneurs and actually made it much quicker because their dream was very much aligned with making money, mm-hmm. And so they monetized what they did very quickly, and it's great. And I actually wholeheartedly support that process because it's not it was also noble. It's not that money is a noble thing. If you pursue it for the greater good of people. But what I pursued, of course, money comes way later. You first have to take a very complex idea and then translate it into something which you can productize and then monetize it. And so it was a hard road. It's not easy. And I'm sure you will agree with me. Working when you come to the human condition and supporting the human condition side, monetization is not easy. But it is. I just had to follow my inner drive and dream, and I never stopped doing that. Now, fortunately, at some point, you might actually agree with me on that one, but I got to a certain point where I almost felt, I'm not sure I'm going to make this. I'm not sure we're going to get through all of this. I'm not sure we're going to make it. But at the same time, I think it's going to be easier to go through, to go forward than to turn around. I even got to a point where I said, there's no turning back. Because I'm too deep into it already. And so then there was almost like a push as well as a pull. But the pull continued to be present. And absolutely to your point, the amount of celebrations, of victories, of far and few between compared to the hardship of actually making something work from an idea to a product, to a monetized product that has product market fit and so forth, and that can grow and scale. So for me, the one thing that I can say that really helped me was to really celebrate all the small victories. So we took a very, very purposeful, committed approach to say every single small victory that we achieve in this company, we will celebrate as if we made it big time. And that never stopped. So we drink to every single thing, every single victory, regardless of its size. And I think that's part of the process, you know, that kept us rewarding and kept us going. And now we start to see things that are starting to blossom. There are things starting to come together. And it's also because of the adjacent possible. I need to share that with you too, Carsten. I'm sure you know this one very well too. You can only do what is possible. You can only actually achieve what you want to achieve to make your dream realize with what is possible in your adjacent vicinity. And so what I had available in my adjacent vicinity in Cape Town with the people around us who invested in rands as opposed to in euros and dollars and pounds, I feel so jealous of that, was actually quite limited. At the same time, there were just the adjacent possible of what was possible. You know, wanting to build a seamless diagnostic with psycholinguistic analysis 5 years ago didn't exist, or 10 years ago. It's up now, it is possible. So the point is that a lot of the dreaming that I was doing, it wasn't possible yet. So I had to find ways of using the adjacent possible, that is, to your point, less sexy, but to get to the point where you can start to use the adjacent possible. I think that's an important one. Very often businesses fail because you continue to dream about something that is just not possible in the adjacent vicinity at the moment. So yeah, we're still here because of, I think, those lessons that we learned. And of course, as an entrepreneur, I don't know about you, Carsten, but I never feel that I arrived. I always feel that there's so much more we need to achieve, like a funnel that just grows out and out. So celebrating small victories again becomes and remains very important.
Yeah, and having this bustling energy that you bring with you, right, to kind of push, continue to push, restart, you know, fall down, get back up, continue to push, that kind of thing kind of at the end of the day makes it, right? That makes all the difference. And I mean, you are part of a big family. You have a part of your five brothers, all of them, you know, married with families and stuff. And your family is, I mean, next to them is NeuroZone to a degree, right? This is the life you chose, right? So that you have identified very much that I'm going to a lot of my time and love and creativity into this way of living.
Yeah, I think so. To your point, I'm single. I would probably say I might still be a bachelor, but at least that time is also, it probably never runs out. But yeah, I'm a single bachelor. I jokingly tell my family, look, I'm the special one. You might think I'm the abnormal one, but I'm the special one, meaning that that I do things differently. But I probably always did things differently. My family, we are five brothers, each is 1 year apart. So we are very, very close in proximity in terms of our age, also in terms of our closeness emotionally. We're very close and a real brotherhood, which is very helpful. My brothers are all entrepreneurs in their own right. It's fascinating. They all started their own thing, were very successful in that way, but also married with children. And so my mother is a great grandmother, but she's also a great grandmother now of one, but a grandmother of 14 grandchildren. My father died 10 years ago, but I've been very privileged to know him very well. My view, I just have to make one point, and I think for anybody who might actually think this for a moment, you don't have to be single to achieve entrepreneurial inventions and innovations and make it work very well. So I think my four brothers attest to that. It's maybe just the way that we live. I find that I live a lot in my head. I'm very continuously dream of a different world, different possibilities. That definitely works in favor when it comes to new ideas and innovations. At NeuroZone, I would also believe that it has got negative effects when it comes to the reality of, hey, why did you settle down with this beautiful person in front of you? And I might think, well, maybe there's something else. And of course, I'm very you know, open to acknowledge that might be a challenge for me, and might well be a challenge in my life that I will never overcome. But at the same time, you know, life in itself is a challenge and it's a journey. So it is what it is. But it's good to be aware of these things.
And there's another thing that makes you a bit special, and that is that you have a passion for singing. So far, so good. But you have a passion for singing classical music from operas. So you're an opera singer. How did that fit in that CV? I mean, how did you find that as a passion for yourself?
Yeah, so Carsten, you know, this is another reason I was so jealous not being born in Europe like you, so I could sing in those beautiful opera houses and also live in the culture of classical music. So I absolutely love being a South African. South Africa, a world of sunshine and sport and barbecues, or what we call braai vleis of braai, all kinds of things. Not so conducive to music, to the culture of music. It is very much appreciated. And living in Cape Town, it is probably more widely accepted and embraced and lived in Cape Town than elsewhere in South Africa. But it's still different. It's not Europe. And so I was born with a passion for singing. My grandmother on my mother's side actually studied singing. She was a professional singer. And I just loved singing. And so as a kid, I thought it wasn't that difficult to sing with an opera voice. So that was something that, which I sort of grew up with. And then, you know, went through the right sort of classical training and studied in the opera school, did all of those things. But of course, as a sideline, as an amateur, and I started giving concerts and being part of different choirs, but then started singing solo. And then I did the proper tenor stuff and loved singing the opera arias of Puccini and Verdi. And of course, Nessun Dorma is a big favorite, but I think it's also, there are so many other incredible opera arias that I just love singing. But, you know, you can't do everything. So when COVID struck, we locked down, and I locked my opera singing down until today. Neurozone stepped into another upward gear during COVID. We were very fortunate, and I became very involved in Neurozone and had to really focus on that. And really dedicate my time into the Neurozone work. But hopefully in the next 6 months or so, I'll be able to take the opera singing up again. And hey, that remains a dream. If somebody asks me, what is the one thing you will want to do before you die? I will sing. I will say, I just want to sing much more than I sing now. Mm. And I would have loved to do something in La Scala or, you know, one of those phenomenal theaters in Europe.
I can almost see you there, so I would definitely come and see and attend, Etienne. So thank you for taking us through this journey through your life. What's next? You spend a lot of time in your head. There's a lot of dreaming and creativity going on. What's the dream not finished, not achieved yet?
So apart from the singing, much more seriously, Carson, you will. I know you will not laugh at this, but I look at you and I think, once again, the word envy. I envy you for the fact that you've written so many books, that you actually have that kind of discipline. I need to write my book, and the next thing for me is to write the book. So being the CEO of the business is very hard to match that with the writing of a book. But the next 6 months for me, the dream is to complete the book. And to get it out there. It also testifies, of course, of the credibility of what we do. So that's an important reason. From a business perspective, that's why we do it. But for me, from a personal perspective, I would just love to have a book written and to then do much more speaking across the world, which is what I was fortunate to do before COVID. That's how we met, actually. You and I met in Chicago. I would love to do that again, to get the message out and to then really actually be part of that process. That is a dream for me. I think it is quite tangible. If you've asked me what is an intangible dream, I would have told you that would have been to be married and have kids. But of course, that's not something that I can control to that degree at the moment.
It's a systemic challenge. I love doing. Another systemic challenge.
Exactly. So I think those are the tangible dreams to accomplish.
Thank you, Etienne. And I'll be looking out for that. I know that you have the rigor and discipline to do that. So it's just a question of how to organize the business in the meantime. That's the stressful thing, right?
Yeah, you know that, right? You know everything about that, Carson.
And what will be a question? That's the question that we always ask our guests. So what haven't I asked you yet, Etienne? What would be interesting for our listeners and viewers to learn about Etienne van der Walt?
I think maybe the question you would ask me that I would maybe is you didn't ask me if I to what extent am I a sports fan?
Mm-hmm. So
and
what
and
about that, sports?
So Carson, I am a fanatic. And I'm a rugby fanatic. I'm a cricket fanatic, like I suppose, like most South African boys. But from that perspective, I've been fortunate to travel to almost all the Rugby World Cups since 1999.
Wow!
With a host of friends, we are always about between 11 and 16 friends who travel together. Many of them have got brothers who played for the Springboks. So these are really big blokes. So I was always known as I was always sort of introduced as the physiotherapist, because I'm not a big bloke. The others were sort of very often mistaken as the real Springbok team on these trips. So I was very fortunate to travel the world, Australia, Europe, England, a lot of Europe, and of course, Australia. Never went to New Zealand, though, and of course, South Africa itself, as a serious sports fan. And I would think that also has some implication. The model that we started off using at NeuroZone, the model of brain performance, of building resilience and brain performance, was conceptualized after many conversations that I had with expert neuroscientists at the sports center, the Cape Town Sports Center down in Cape Town. They're called the Sports Science Institute. So everything is actually born from that. I see sport as a laboratory for life. You know, the goal is to stay alive in life, but you have a goal that you have to achieve on a sports field. You've got teams. So effectively, it's a laboratory where the life is just shortened and intensified pretty much. And there's a lot in there. So I'm fascinated. I always say I'm actually fascinated about sport because it's got such an academic value. But I know that's not completely true. So I'm a serious sports fan.
So when is the next World Cup?
Well, the next one is this year, right? So South Africa is the holder of the World Cup. We won the World Cup in Japan just before before COVID. And this one is in France. And France is pretty much hot favorites together with Ireland. I know who's going to win the World Cup, but I'm not going to tell anybody that.
So when in France, let me know, and we will grab a beer or two or three.
Yes, absolutely, man. We're just going to hop across, and I would love to see you in Heidelberg again. But if you come to Paris, equally so, fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm really looking forward to that.
It was great catching up. All the best to you, and I could ask hundreds more questions. There will be so much more to learn, but that has to wait for our next episode. Thank you, Tien. All the best.
Thank you, Carsten. And thank you, Carsten. I really appreciate it. All the best with your wonderful business, too.
Thank you. Bye-bye. That's fascinating stuff. And Tien is such a purpose-driven person. And you can really feel this passion that he has about this. And the way how he's also willing to make sacrifices to improve the human condition, which is not a small goal to achieve in life, but probably very worthwhile. So what are your thoughts? Let me hear your reflections, your feedback, your thoughts. Send us an email at leaderstalk@leadership-choices.com. We're looking very much forward to hearing back from you. And now, all the best, stay healthy, and see you next time at Leaders Talk.